Texas has just under half of all Bitcoin mining in the United States and nearing 20% of the global hash rate, actually, just in Texas. And that's really because Texas is an energy abundant state. So it's really about economics. It's the miners found extremely, extremely cheap energy. And the beautiful part about it is they are soaking up this stranded and wasted energy.
Hello, and welcome to Public Key, the podcast from Chainalysis. This is your host, Ian Andrews. As the saying goes, everything is bigger in Texas, and it holds true for their blockchain technology ambitions too. Today I speak with Lee Bratcher. He's the founder and president of the Texas Blockchain Council. He's one of the pivotal figures making sure that Texas is a leader in digital asset innovation. Lee shares how he's intent on positioning Texas as a front runner in blockchain policy. We also discuss some of the recent legal battles that the Blockchain Council has had with the U.S. Department of Energy and the SEC. And we also get into the energy economics of Bitcoin mining in Texas. Now, if you weren't able to attend the Chainalysis Links conference in New York last week, well, you missed a fantastic event. But don't despair. We're going to run virtual replays of some of the best content in early May. We'll include a link to register in the show notes. We've also published some great hot takes from the event on our blog and social platforms, so definitely check those out. Last thing. As always, please remember, this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, or investment advice. And while this episode discusses some in-depth legal and regulatory matters, listeners should consult their own advisors before making these types of decisions.
Today, I am joined by Lee Bratcher, who's the founder and president of the Texas Blockchain Council. Lee, welcome to the show.
Ian, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Lee, I feel like you and I have known each other for a really long time because I get emails signed by you with regularity, you and the Blockchain Council, of course. But this is actually our first conversation. So we're going to do all the introductions and get to know yous live for the podcast. I've stalked your LinkedIn profile a little bit. You have, I would describe as an unusual path to your current role. Maybe start with a little bit of background and how you got into this world of cryptocurrency.
Yeah, it is a little unorthodox. So out of college, went to Army Candidacy School, Officer Candidacy School with the U.S. Army. I'm an Army Reserve Officer for the 75th Innovation Command, which supports Army Futures Command. So I've been doing that for about 14 years. I was a political science professor at a small university here in Dallas called Dallas Baptist University. And my research area was property rights. And then when I was at the Army War College in Pennsylvania, I found the Bitcoin white paper in, say, 2015, 2016. And so that really put me down a road of, okay, there can be digital scarcity. There are digital property rights. And my research really turned to that. And I started to organize different folks in the industry with elected officials, state, local, and federal. And it required more regularity and more time. And so it eventually turned into the Texas Blockchain Council in 2019. And I quit my job to do it full time in 2020.
Wow. The point of digital property rights is one that I think maybe slightly lost on people who read about price of Bitcoin going up and down, and that's their only participation in the ecosystem. But talk a little bit more about why that was interesting to you and what got you excited when you read the white paper and started to educate yourself more in the concept.
Yeah, my research was really a foundational book was Hernando de Soto's Mystery of Capital. Hernando de Soto is a Peruvian economist who's sort of famous for this concept that property rights essentially are our way of capitalism is not easily exportable. They're institutions that are learned over decades and centuries, and you can't really just create a playbook because not any one person or group of people or even government is capable of replicating the shared cultural consciousness that's required for robust property rights. And so there's also some interesting concepts, you know, around other authors like Mansur Olson, who writes about collective action problems. And essentially, we've never had a tool that allows us to solve some of these really complex social problems in the digital space. And what's ironic is the digital implementation of these tools that we know as public blockchains that started with Bitcoin are actually more effective than what we've developed in the analog world. world from a governance perspective. They're more perfectible, if you will. And if those authors were still around today, they would be fascinated to see where we've come. And of course, we're a long way from having all value transmitted on public ledgers, but I think we've crossed some pivotal junctures in that direction.
Say more about how you envision governance working better on blockchain than it does in, say, like the US system today. Because, you know, as an end user experience participating in a few DAOs, it feels really clunky to me. Not to say that the American system doesn't often also feel clunky, but I'm just curious. I feel like you've maybe got a better vision to the future of where that's going than I do as an end user.
Well, I will say that I think it's a long ways off on the public sector side, on the governance side. I think anything having to do with finance and business and economics, there's just more incentives for faster adoption. So take everything that I'm about to say with a huge grain of salt. I think it's a long ways off on the public sector side just because there's no incentives to push it forward. And we have reasonably functioning in some areas, systems of property rights, governance, rule of law, et cetera. But I do think it starts with digital identity. Every application that you see, if you follow that down a logical path, you realize that you have to have digital identifiers, digital identity, self-sovereign digital identity, hopefully, right? One in which the state actors are collaborative partners, to be sure, and sort of still are the participants in identifying their citizens, but not one in which they are like the ultimate in control, sort of a Chinese model where like a social credit score could be easily imposed. And then things follow on from there. There's a lot of innovative stuff. I think property administration, real world assets is a linkage between the private sector and the public sector because there's a lot of responsibility on the public sector with regard to real world assets, specifically real estate. Then you've got some things that are purely in the governmental realm, like voting and things of that nature, which I do think are a long ways off. But there's countries in the Baltic, Eastern Europe that are adopting it. Estonia is pretty far along with some success. So that's a minefield, though, for sure.
Yeah. You wrote a paper back in 2018 that focused on blockchain and land registries. What's your reflection as you look back 6 years later? Do you feel like the concepts you outlined in the paper, you know, are we trending towards them? It feels like everyone wants to talk about real world assets and the crypto ecosystem and real estate being a part of that, I suppose. But do you feel like we've made progress?
Yeah, I think we have. I think the thing holding us back on sort of the tokenized private equity side is too many platforms, too many ATSs, alternative trading systems, and there needs to be a way for people to just log into their account, their Charles Schwab-esque account. Of course, it's not going to be Charles Schwab, but something similar, and see all of these potential investment opportunities for accredited investors, these tokenized securities that are real estate tokenized private equity, essentially. So that's a huge problem. You know, you need the liquidity and the eyeballs to make those deals profitable and work. Otherwise, the legal expense and expense of tokenizing an asset like real estate, commercial real estate, it just doesn't pencil out.
Yeah.
So I think we'll get there because that's just the trajectory. I mean, BlackRock is tokenizing money market funds. It'll happen. On the public sector side, which is really what I wrote about, land registries, my hypothesis was that it's not a technical problem. It is a political problem and a stakeholder management problem. Back in 2018, when I wrote the paper, all of the academics were saying, no, blockchains, public or private blockchains, neither one are capable technically of handling land registries. And now in 2024, it's almost laughable. It's like very clearly it is technically feasible with a public or private chain. It's just there's trade-offs there. But what the holdup is there are stakeholders in this process that don't want to see that happen. And it's understandable and I think is going to require a lot of time.
Maybe jump forward to today and let's talk about your organization, Texas Blockchain Council. What made you take that leap into starting this as, you know, a full-time endeavor, not just a side act? And talk a little bit about what the organization's focused on, you know, now in 2024.
Yeah, we're a 501c6 trade association. So like your chambers of commerce, essentially. We represent about 95 corporate members and several hundred individuals, both on the advocacy and lobbying side, and then also as a business development amplifier. And so we do focus on Texas, but we have inroads and relationships at the federal level. And also I chair the U.S. Blockchain Coalition, which is a group of about 40 state associations across the country of varying levels. You know, some of them are more mature and some of them are just getting started. And so we share best practices and work on, you know, collective policy together. We've gotten a couple wins under our belt. We've got two bills passed in 2021 and two more in 2023. When I started the Texas Blockchain Council in 2019, the Brookings Institute rated Texas as reactionary and really not digital asset friendly. And so we really changed the narrative there. And now Texas is looked at as sort of a bastion. And, you know, Texas and Wyoming are two of the states that have really carved out that niche. And we really respect what Wyoming's done. And they've pioneered a lot of the things that we've worked on as well. And we've worked on it jointly with them. So it's been an interesting journey. I mean, and now we're getting into suing the federal government. So we just sued the federal government last month. And they tucked tail and ran in pretty short order, about 2 weeks. And not because we're intimidating to the federal government by any means, but just because they didn't have any legal ground to stand on. And, you know, they'd made some errors in sort of Administrative Procedure Act type nuance.
Talk about the matter at issue in that case, in case folks listening aren't familiar with it.
Sure. Yeah. So Senator Warren put some pressure on the Department of Energy Secretary to conduct a study of Bitcoin mining across the U.S. And they used the Energy Information Administration, which is under the Department of Energy, to do this study. And that administration typically studies generation and transmission. They very rarely differentiate on load because load can be anything, right? You don't really have it's very subjective. What we found was that they made some errors in the way that they went about the study. They conducted an emergency survey. The last time they had conducted an emergency survey was during Hurricane Sandy, and there was an actual emergency. They also targeted a specific industry that they had never done before, and there was clear evidence on the record of Elizabeth Warren pressuring them to do this. So it was clearly political and pretextual. And so we sued on procedural grounds and won there. We didn't sue on substantive grounds, but there were some substantive concerns because they were asking a lot of inappropriate questions that required these U.S. companies to disclose private information that would have caused competitive harm. And the EIA in their mandate is, you know, not permitted to cause competitive harm. So I think if they redo the survey and ask for energy consumption of Bitcoin mining, then that will be appropriate and we'll respond accordingly, probably ask them to do that for the entire data center industry and not just Bitcoin mining or digital asset mining, because AI compute is already larger than digital asset mining.
It has to be, probably by a substantial amount, I would expect, given the growth.
My back of the napkin math is that if you include hyperscalers and cloud with AI, yeah, it's like 4x yeah, the size. And even if you don't include the hyperscalers, it's still larger, but not four times yeah, as large.
Talk about mining in Texas a little bit, because there's been a couple, I think, geopolitical changes that have made Texas, from what I can tell, an epicenter of mining. It started a few years ago when China blocked the practice, because I think we had an over-concentration, particularly on the Bitcoin network, operating from China, largely due to low energy prices. But when politicians in China sort of shifted, said, okay, we're not doing this anymore, all of a sudden, you know, a lot of these mining rigs got relocated. And it seems like Texas was the beneficiary of that in terms of creating almost a new industry from scratch.
That's right. Yeah. Texas has just under half of all Bitcoin mining in the United States.
Wow.
And nearing 20% of the global hash rate, actually, just in Texas. And that's really because Texas is an energy abundant state, but it's so large that we have transmission problems. We don't have the sufficient transmission networks to get our abundant energy, whether that's wind, solar, or natural gas, to the large population centers. So particularly in West Texas, we have a ton of energy generation, but there's not a lot of people that live out in West Texas, and it's prohibitively expensive to build a lot of generation out there. So you can have negative energy prices on a really windy day when wind is generating a lot of energy. There's just more energy than can be taken by the transmission lines. So it's really about economics. It's the miners found extremely, extremely cheap energy. And the beautiful part about it is they are soaking up this stranded and wasted energy. You know, you'll never find a Bitcoin miner using energy when someone else couldn't use energy, because they are so price sensitive. And the Texas market is a deregulated market. So that means that, you know, when demand goes up, price goes up correspondingly. And Bitcoin miners are very allergic to high prices. And, you know, we have a lot of data from ERCOT, not from us, but from the grid operator here, that shows Bitcoin miners curtail during high prices. And so we're not going to be on during that hot summer day at 5 p.m. when everyone's cranking up their AC, because for two reasons. One, because we want to be good grid citizens and good corporate citizens, but two, we don't want to pay those costs.
Right. It's a very interesting workload. Like if you look at it at a technical level, you know, comparing to things that run in, say, any one of the hyperscale cloud providers like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, most of the things there are applications that have to be on all the time, right? Yeah. There's end users who connect to it. Like I'm looking at a Google Docs app right now. If that goes away, you know, my day is kind of ruined. Bitcoin mining, though, if you're not operating those servers profitably, meaning the block reward for putting transactions on chain is less than what you've got to pay to operate that infrastructure, you're going to turn it off. And I think a lot of people misunderstand that nuance. And they assume that, you know, miners are just going to run these machines no matter what, 24 hours a day, all day long. And that would cost a lot of people a lot of money. It would be a very unprofitable business if they took that approach.
It really would be, because prices in Texas can fluctuate from a few cents a kilowatt hour to like hundreds of dollars a kilowatt hour and thousands of dollars a megawatt hour. So it is a unique dynamic, and most people have never looked at how grids work. Managing a grid is really tough, and managing how much generation and consumption. You've got a lot of renewables in Texas. About a third of our grid is renewables, and they fluctuate. And then you've got your usage, your energy pull from consumers is also fluctuating. You know, overnight it's very low, midday it's low, in the mornings it's high, in the afternoons it's really high. So it's got this very variable pattern to it. And then you have seasonal patterns. So not an easy engineering feat. And our hats go off to grid operators across the country for, you know, they're sort of unsung heroes of electrical engineering.
Absolutely. And for the grid operator, they've got these really high long-term capital investment problems. Right? Like it costs a lot to build more generation capacity. And they also have to operate profitably. And so if they don't have a consumer in the middle of the night, because we're all asleep, we're not running our TVs and our air conditioning, our computers, if weather changes can impact them. I think the Bitcoin mining has the ability to provide profitable demand in these kind of off-peak hours that allows the grid operator to build generation capacity to the actual consumption peak, high demand driven, you know, not off mining, but off of all the other activity that's going along. There's economics in here. We've had Jamie Leverton, who was CEO at Hut 8 on the podcast previously and got into this topic as well, because she was facing a lot of political challenges in Canada. And folks just, I think, are missing a lot of the nuances here. And they just see, oh, this is energy consumptive, therefore terrible. Talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing at the federal level. In the news this week as we're recording, Coinbase versus the SEC has been a topic. You filed an amicus brief. Talk about your strategy there and what you're trying to accomplish with that filing.
Coinbase is really an actor that I think as an industry we all need to support, because they have spent a tremendous amount of money on compliance. Of course, going public was not cheap, being the first exchange to go public. And if Coinbase is unsuccessful, then we as an industry are set back tremendously. And I'm not saying they need to be successful in this suit on every single count. But just in general, in their endeavors against the SEC, we need to support them with all vigor. So we did file an amicus brief along with Satoshi Action Fund. And essentially, we were supporting their lawsuit and their motion to dismiss. We saw this week was granted on one count. Of course, you know, we all expected that it would not be granted, sort of a procedural item on the other counts. But we did see a win this week for them with the Coinbase wallet portion of the lawsuit being dismissed. And Ian, you and I were talking before the show, that was pretty technical analysis and astute understanding of what was happening on a non-custodial wallet, digital wallet that Coinbase, you know, provides by the judge and by the judge's clerks.
Tremendous analysis by the judge and whoever he met with, because it's hard to, I think, for the casual observer to look at a product like Coinbase Wallet and go, well, it says Coinbase. Like, what do you mean that Coinbase isn't operating that on behalf of their customers? Therefore, they must be a broker. And I think the ruling correctly identified that no, Coinbase Wallet, while branded Coinbase, is very clearly a non-custodial, meaning Coinbase is taking no possession of the digital assets contained in that wallet. The trades or asset purchases or any other activity conducted with the wallet is all directed by the user. The Coinbase is really not involved, which I think is tremendous, actually. Like, one of the hardest things I think about the work you're doing and, you know, anybody else who's dealing with with either the legal system or the political system around blockchain is like, this stuff is incredibly technically complex. Even for, you know, you and I, who probably spend an inordinate amount of time thinking about the space. What's your prediction on where this case goes, if you have one? Because they're going to move to trial on the other charges that the SEC filed now that the motion to dismiss has been denied on the other pieces. Any predictions?
Well, I think they have a strong case. I did note that it's going to be a jury trial, which I think might have been a little bit surprising. But they've got some of the top legal minds in the world. Gene Scalia, I know, is one of their attorneys. They've got several others who are just absolutely brilliant. So I expect them to be successful on most counts. I think perhaps even all. Maybe the jury is actually a good thing, because it's pretty clear to the casual observer that the SEC is not, you know, protecting investors. They're essentially just a political arm of the federal government to try to pick winners and losers. And so they're really kind of outside their depth here. But, you know, you never can discount the federal government. They have unlimited resources to prosecute these cases, and Chevron deference is still in place, unless something's happened in the last few days that I missed. I know that's being challenged, but I am optimistic though.
One of the points that struck me, your amicus brief made this over and over, is like 40% of people in the United States own digital assets in some form. So, you know, soon I would expect we'll have a majority of Americans owning digital assets. It seems not in the public's interest to shut down a company like Coinbase, who, as you said, has gone to great lengths to be compliant, collaborate with law enforcement, try and root out bad actors that may be abusing the digital assets ecosystem. They seem like one of the good guys to me. Talk about this other case. I actually wasn't familiar with this one until I started doing a little research for the show, with DeFi Education Fund preemptively filing a suit against the SEC related to Biba Coin. This is a local Texas organization I think you're familiar with. Talk a bit about what they're doing and then what the lawsuit with the SEC is all about.
Yeah, Biba is local. They are very small, you know, nascent organization. And essentially, they were airdropping tokens as a marketing tool. And they're actually selling limited edition apparel items and like bags and things of that nature. And so the airdrops were free. The token has no value at this point in time, or at least none that I'm aware of. And so they're filing a preemptive action, sort of pre-enforcement, if you will, to request a declaratory judgment on, you know, the SEC's rulemaking process, and asking the SEC to follow the Administrative Procedures Act in the way that they adopt guidance for companies like this that are conducting a free airdrop. There's clearly not a securities offering. You know, there's no money being changing hands here. So they've got a really good case. I think the airdrop is very clearly not a security, and the SEC is going to have their hands full with this one for sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting case where you have what amounts to a marketing promotion, you know, which in my role, I think about all the time. It's clearly not a security offering. It's not a case, you know, like we saw with some of the ICOs back in 2017, where it was clearly, hey, take this token. It represents a share in the company that we've created. Those words were never used, but it was pretty straightforward and clear. That was what, you know, a number of companies were trying to do. This seems like such a clearly different thing, aside from the fact that in both cases, you have a digital asset token being created on a blockchain. I hope that this one results in a clear win. I mean, we've seen organizations like Starbucks and a number of other big brands who have also created, you know, relatively similar types of offerings, I think, intended for customer retention or marketing promotions, that really should not get swept up in the securities issues.
I agree. It's sad that we have come to this, but I think the SEC's put their flag in the ground and we have to push them back in the courts. There's really no other way.
Yeah. One of the things your organization, I think, has become famous for is an event called the North American Blockchain Summit. The most recent one just happened in the fall, but I think you're already programming for the 2024 edition coming up in November. I haven't had the opportunity to attend, but I've heard this is a fantastic event. A couple of my colleagues have attended previous ones. Talk a little bit about what you're trying to do with that event and what we can expect coming up this year.
Yeah, that's a conference that we put on to bring in policymakers and regulators, have conversations with industry executives, bring the community together, the industry together, and be a little bit more, I think, cognizant of the political environment. So it's a little bit different than, say, you know, a Consensus or a Bitcoin Miami or Bitcoin Nashville this year, where it has a more of a festival vibe and there's just a ton of folks there. Our goal is to make it a little bit more cerebral and, you know, inject those policy conversations into the mix. And so this year we're doing it in Dallas at the George Bush Presidential Library. They've got a beautiful institute there behind the library where it's kind of a conference area and very stately. You feel like you're walking down the halls of the Department of State when you're there. So we're excited about it. You know, we've hosted folks anywhere from Vivek Ramaswamy, RFK Jr., several U.S. senators like Senator Cruz, Senator Lummis, Senator Wyden. And we try to take a bipartisan approach. Of course, being from Texas, we understand that the Texas legislature and all statewide elected offices are held by Republicans and have generally had a good reception, you know, on that side of the aisle. And I think we're having a good reception on the other side of the aisle, but in specific parts of the Democratic Party and certainly not all. And I think it actually ends up being more of an aid thing than anything. You know, we found that Democrats and Republicans in Texas, when we did some surveying with some third-party surveying companies, that they are pretty much equally likely to be supportive from a sentiment analysis and also to own digital assets. The real distinguishing factor was age. Only 6% of people over the age of 65 own digital assets, whereas 50%+ of people under the age of 30.
I've been bothered by it seems like digital assets in the last 2 years has shifted from a bipartisan issue to a Republican issue. And at least at the national level, I'm less familiar with the situation in Texas, but it doesn't on the face of it make sense if you think about the respective parties' platforms, to be honest, right? If you take the Democratic platform as being pro-individual consumer protection, kind of anti-big finance, if I summarize their position that way, it would seem like the cryptocurrency ecosystem would be, you know, a terrific opportunity to kind of mute the impact or potentially even disrupt, in the technology sense of the word, big finance, drive some positive change and rights back to the retail side consumers. But somehow it seems like that's been lost on the Democratic platform and we've run down this seemingly increasingly partisan path. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it wasn't inevitable. And to your point, I think it could have been more bipartisan. It could have flipped the other way. But I think what we had that put us down this path was some pretty influential people at the top of either party that had their mind made up. And they sent signals to other members of their party. And those signals were received in due course. And, you know, and I'm thinking here of Senator Warren. She is so influential within the Democratic Party and very clearly had her mind made up early on for a number of different reasons. My main reason is she sort of makes her living as an elected official, and I'm using that in like in a figurative sense, by railing against something. And there wasn't really somebody who had really taken up the cause to rail against crypto, digital assets, etc. And there was an opportunity, a political opportunity for her. And she's sort of twisted the narratives to make sense for her platform and, you know, her political beliefs. So I agree. It wasn't a foregone conclusion. I do think that those signals sent from various folks greatly influence the trajectory. And you've got people like Richie Torres, and you've got Democrats at the national level, and even Democrats here in Texas. We have some of our bills are carried by Democrats who are innovative and they believe in decentralization. You know, they have aligned values, and it really doesn't cut across, and even politics in general. You know, the two-party system is unfairly putting people into buckets for sure, but certainly in digital assets as well. Yeah. It certainly has the tendency to do that.
Maybe based on the survey data you brought up a moment ago, we just need to move to the next generation of politicians, right? As we age out, some of the folks in office now will naturally have a broader base to be proponents for digital assets.
Yeah, I think that is very clear. And it all goes back to incentives. And people that are younger in office have longer time horizons, and they have just different relationships with industry. And people who are older have established relationships and shorter time horizons. And both of those things work against the older elected officials being. Now, it's not a rule, it just is a trend. There are some elected officials that are generations ahead of us that are incredibly well-read on this issue. So by no means is it universal, but it is certainly a trend that we found.
I have to ask you about the interview you did with Balaji Srinivasan. He is such an epic character in the industry that we're both a part of. What led to that conversation? You know, what was the experience like being on the interviewer side of talking to Balaji?
Yeah, it was an honor, certainly. You know, we connected on Twitter DMs, as most good conversations start. And he was familiar with our work, and we're obviously familiar with him and sort of his concept, you know, the network state and his past work. As I believe maybe the first CTO at Coinbase, I don't know if he was the first, but very early, and certainly been a legend since. And I think connected on a few concepts that gave me an in to ask for an interview, and conducted that interview the morning of our North American Blockchain Summit. It was like midnight his time in Singapore. And I was in my hotel room about to head over to the conference. So not the most professional interview that we've done, but certainly appreciate his wisdom. And I think he sees things far in advance and many steps ahead of the way that most people, including myself, are viewing things. And it causes him to perhaps sound a little bit outlandish to sort of the average person. But those of us that maybe are in this space can see how profound, you know, his thoughts are. And, you know, I think in the years to come, many of those will be borne out.
Yeah, I think a lot of people see like his bet that he made about the price of Bitcoin going to $1 million. And I don't think it quite got there, although we've seen a nice appreciation recently in the digital assets that I think most of us are happy about. But they see that kind of like outlandish behavior on social media and they think that's what he's all about. And I think he's actually such a deep thinker. There's a lot behind that that I would encourage people to dig in, go listen to the interview you did and read some of his writing if you're interested in the space.
I second that.
One of the things that I picked up on in your background, both the military service, but also working as a police officer, and a lot of the work that we do at Chainalysis is kind of on the catching the bad guys who are abusing digital asset platforms. I'm curious how you think about that. I mean, you must encounter that as an objection as you're working to educate lawmakers or you're talking to various parts of government. What do you see as the right message to carry forward to those audiences when it comes to illicit activity in cryptocurrency?
You know, we're grateful for organizations like Chainalysis. I interviewed on our podcast Gervis Grigg, who's, I believe, y'all's CTO for North American for the public sector. And he has a FBI background and brings just tremendous experience to Chainalysis. And we essentially are equipped with data from you guys and others that help us craft a narrative that is slowly taking root. I think the media has not been helpful in that because they have a much larger microphone and a much larger distribution than trade associations like us. But we use those tools and we say, hey, we're not going to tell you that there's zero criminal activity happening on public blockchains. But what we will tell you is to look at the data and make a determination for yourself as to what trajectory, what direction, what trend lines the data show in criminal activity and what trend lines you see in traditional finance. And neither are immaculate, but I would venture that most people, after looking at the data, will see the trend lines and say, hey, digital assets are more transparent and there will probably always be some level of criminal activity on any, I mean, not probably, there will be on any, you know, value transfer platform. But what we can do is we can support organizations that work with law enforcement to make that as small a part of the story as possible. And yeah, I think the biggest narrative is just showing the trend lines. And you guys do that with your yearly statistics and the data that you put out. So we're thankful to have that and it equips us to have those conversations with elected officials.
Yeah, terrific. What do you think about the Bitcoin spot ETFs? This has been the big news of the year, I think, for a lot of people in the cryptocurrency ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a long time coming, and I feel bad for the Winklevoss twins who, you know, applied a decade ago. But I do continue to hear from allies and friends, both in the legislature, elected officials, and in traditional finance and you know, family offices, that the ETFs, of course, they're an on-ramp, right? That's clear to everybody, but it sends a message. It sends a message that we've turned a corner from where we were in 2022. And that was not a good year for digital assets from a narrative and sort of reputational perspective. And so getting in firms involved like BlackRock and Franklin Templeton and some of these, you know, Fidelity, these large asset managers, I think scares some people in our community just because they are the epitome of traditional finance. But what I would say is we've had enough time to mature as an industry to be prepared to onboard those caliber of companies. And there's not really any risk of co-option or, of a BlackRock taking a stance that, you know, is sort of antithetical to decentralization, right? Yeah. So I could be wrong in that, but my assessment is that we are far enough along and we are sufficiently decentralized across layer ones that the layer ones that are going to be consequential for decades to come are quite robust. And BlackRock is going to take advantage of that and make money off of that, which is great. That's capitalism. But they're going to sail down the path of least resistance while they make that money, which is the path that's been set up by builders who've decentralization has been a key tenet in their philosophy.
It's great perspective. Maybe we get worried if BlackRock launches their own layer one chain. Maybe that'll set off alarm bells. But I think short of that, it's all goodness to have pool of entrance into the ecosystem for all of us. This has been a fantastic conversation. My traditional closing question, like, what are you excited about in 2024? What are you going to be spending time on? What should we look ahead for?
You know, I like to talk about this concept because it hasn't happened yet, but it's something that we're thinking through. And I keep putting it out there on interviews because I keep getting people emailing saying, hey, we heard you on this interview talking about this concept. I've got to give credit. There was another gentleman who brought it to me, and I won't say his name just to protect him. But the concept is, and this is one of many that we're working on, including some of our amici briefs, if you will. The plural of amicus is such a funny word. But the concept is essentially getting more state and national adoption and understanding through almost a forcing function. So the concept is to establish a trust, and this benefactor of the trust, in our case would be the state of Texas, the rainy day fund, or something within the comptroller's jurisdiction. You know, we have a bullion depository here in Texas, which is unique amongst most states. We brought our gold back from New York, and we now, you know, it's here locally in Leander, Texas. So the idea is that the benefactor would be the state, and the state would take possession of the trust, only at which point they're willing to self-custody in cold storage whatever assets the trust holds. And so we'll have people donate assets to the trust. You know, maybe you're donating a Bitcoin or half a Bitcoin or two Bitcoin or whatever, and that incentivizes, you know, you're on the board of the trust if you make a donation of certain size, and then the state, you know, has to wait until they're willing to take possession of these funds. It's really not going to be a lot of money. It's going to be an inconsequential amount of money for a state the size of Texas, you know, with close to 25% of the national GDP. But it would be an incredible, almost like educational exercise. You know, imagine if the bullion gold depository in Texas had treasures and ledgers in it. So that's something that I'm excited about. And, you know, we've got a lot of other initiatives that we're working on in the legislature from a policy perspective. But that's kind of a fun one that I like to put out there that hopefully won't bore people to tears. You know, you don't want me talking about, you know, our plans for the next legislative session because it might put people to sleep.
I'm all for it. Let's get some hardware wallet devices in the gold depository right alongside all the gold bullion. Lee, this has been fantastic. Thanks for taking the time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me in.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to another episode. If you enjoyed what you heard today, do me a favor. Right now, open up your podcast app, rate the show, give us a review, tell us what you liked. Even better, share the podcast with your friends. And of course, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Last thing before you go. Just last month, a Washington, D.C. jury decided that Roman Sterlingov was indeed the individual who ran the Bitcoin Fog Mixer and subsequently found him guilty of laundering tens of millions of dollars from illicit darknet market activity. But this case had far-reaching implications beyond the conviction. Earlier during the trial, Judge Randolph Moss of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia ruled in a Doebert order that Chainalysis blockchain analytics is reliable and therefore admissible as substantive evidence, wholly rejecting the defense's arguments. That Doebert ruling sets a precedent that's important for several reasons. First, it gives prosecutors a valuable tool to prove guilt at trial. Second, it affirms the auditability and transparency of Chainalysis blockchain analytics, which is crucial for many agencies that rely on our solutions to investigate illicit activity. Click the link to our blog you can find in the show notes, and we'll tell you more about how this ruling came to be and what it means for the future of blockchain analytics.